There is a lot of violence and crime in Johannesburg. It's not an easy place in that sense. But there are also a lot of very good people, I suppose, like anywhere. But there is really a legacy there of a lot of pain, and there is a lot of violence.
Is it a post-apartheid legacy, would you say?
Very much so. And I think that, you know, 20 years on, more than 20 years since the first democratic elections, which were in 1994, we're really still struggling very much with a traumatized society and with the effects of an apartheid system that really eroded people's sense of dignity and who they are as people. And we are still really trying to come to terms as a society with so much of what happened in the apartheid era.
I think that's an interesting point. People might look and say, my goodness, it wasn't that long ago. It's 24 years, nearly 25. And yet apartheid was really embedded in the whole of society. And when you have a system like that, I mean, it affects not only the people who were oppressed, but also those who were doing the oppression as well, because everybody becomes part of the problem.
Very, very much so. I grew up in South Africa under apartheid. I was still at school for most of the time, completely unaware in some senses of the evil that was going on and the system that I was part of, until I got to university, where I was part of the university Catholic chaplaincy. There were Jesuits who were involved there, and that really opened my eyes. We did a lot of work on the interface between faith and life and faith and justice. And it was really around the early 90s that I arrived at university and was exposed to the reality of my own situation in my own country. And I think now we have a situation in which many people are having to really grapple with what happened in South Africa, and that we were part of that, whether we were conscious of it or unconscious of it in some ways at the time. And there's a real burden of guilt that people carry. But there's also a sense in which there's sometimes quite a bit of frustration from the younger generation of white people in South Africa, for example, who weren't around during apartheid, who feel as though they're carrying the blame for something which they were not directly responsible for.
I think that's very interesting, because that does leave a legacy that, you know, you weren't directly responsible for it, yet somehow, as a white South African, do you feel addressed by it, that there's something that you're called to do, and yet guilt can be crippling and not helpful?
I think it's a very complex issue. I mean, I think the first thing is that we're only now starting to become aware of what we talk about in terms of white privilege, the fact that just by virtue of having been born white, even now, post-apartheid, we are born into a context in which we have historically more access to education, more access to opportunity, more access to all kinds of things which have advantaged us in a way that many black people, most black people, have not even now had access to. And yet I think it's about how do we come to a place of healing and reconciliation. And we're very much in the Jesuit Institute where I work, trying to work in projects around that. And even in the spiritual direction work that I'm busy with, it's incredible the kind of stuff that happens when we train people from different parts of the South African community as spiritual directors, and they get to share their stories and to talk about what it was like and what it is like to be black or white or coloured, what we call so-called coloured, in the South African community. And there's an amazing sense of the growth that happens when people are able to honestly share the reality of their experience with one another.
Looking at yourself in that situation, you're a spiritual director, you're white, and somebody comes to you and you have to listen to what they went through while you were merrily bouncing off to school and doing very nicely, thank you. Do you have to do work on yourself, first of all, to deal with how you're affected by what they're telling you, what in your name, or at least in the name of the white people, was done to, say, the black community or the coloured community?
Very much so. You know, I spend most of my time training people as spiritual directors and also training supervisors to help spiritual directors to reflect on their own personal experience of what's being triggered for them as they listen, and for myself too, what's being triggered for me as I listen. I had an experience not that long ago of listening to somebody who had listened to a person who'd been severely traumatized under apartheid, to someone in her family had been tortured and gone missing and had died. And as she shared that pain, the spiritual director really struggled, because she was realizing, as she said to me, that it was realizing that it was what my people had done to her, and having to really kind of have a safe space where she could talk about how that impacted on her.
And not just talk. It's important to talk, sure, and to be aware and to understand. I'm interested in, is there something else then, like, in the whole area of spirituality, because your area is that interface between spirituality and psychology. So in the psychological approach, we're talking it out, we're revisiting it, looking at it again. Does the spiritual dimension bring anything different then to the talking it out, the sharing, the supervision?
I mean, I think one of the things that's very deeply impacted in all of this is our image of God and our image of ourselves. Because in a sense, in a very traumatized context, people's image of God can become very distorted. And I think that there is something about helping people into a place of prayer, and we would use very much the Ignatian frame, because that's the training background that I come from. And one of the ways of prayer that we found incredibly freeing for people is actually praying with the imagination, imaginative contemplation, that somehow opening up that as an imaginal, not imaginary, but an imaginal space in which one can allow a new image, a more helpful, healing image of God to break in. I did my doctoral thesis around some of this, and you know, I work as a psychotherapist, and when I work with people in that way, it can often take a very long time for healing to happen, I've noticed myself. And when we journey with people also on the spiritual level, it seems as though somehow as God breaks into that experience, very often people are met at their place of deepest need and hurt by the God who knows them intimately. And an image comes, a way of seeing God, that also shifts something about the way that that person experiences themselves and gives them back a sense of their own dignity, their own worth, their own value.
Can you just say a bit to me about the image of God that's affected by people who are traumatic? I mean, what kind of image do they tend to project then about God and themselves?
I think they tend to be quite negative images of God, an image of God who either is a very abandoning God, a neglectful God, or an image of a God who is quite punitive. It's also quite interesting how many women in particular sometimes struggle with a very masculine and very oppressive kind of sense of God. And it's almost as though opening up a space to engage imaginatively with the scriptures, particularly, sometimes creates a chink in that space for something different to emerge.
So give me an example. I mean, would somebody take a scene from the gospel and imagine themselves in it, and are they guided to do that, or explain that to me?
So generally we might offer somebody a passage with, for example, Jesus engaged doing something with someone. I always remember, for example, the story of Martha and Mary, where Jesus goes to the house of Martha and Mary, as many people will know. Martha is busy in the kitchen with the dishes and the washing up and the preparations and all the rest of it. And her sister Mary is sitting at Jesus' feet. And when Martha comes in and gets quite frustrated with this, you know, Jesus is saying, well, Mary has chosen the better part. Let her be. Let her listen. And I always remember an experience of someone praying around something with that. And this is something she said, I can share, no problem. And she was so frustrated, and she was saying, Jesus, you have no idea what it's like to be a woman, and you have no idea how it's like to be a woman raped. And as she was looking at Jesus there, he became a woman, and she saw him on the cross saying to her, I do know. I know what it's like. And it was a profoundly healing moment for her, because she had been someone who had experienced enormous trauma in her life.
And do you believe people can be healed, really healed, of that kind of trauma? Is it a wound that's always there, ready to be poked and sore again? Or is it that we come to terms with it and learn to live with that in a way that we're at peace?
It's a very interesting question. I think that it depends a bit on the person and on their situation and what kind of experience they might have in prayer. I think that, you know, from a psychological point of view, often it takes a lot of time for people coming to terms with something realizing the impact that it's had on them, having the space to grieve, to mourn, to cry, to let the feelings be there, a kind of cathartic sense. And then a time of reintegration and making sense of their lives in the wake of what's happened to them. Where I think spirituality can really play an added role is that I think that in that reintegration process, in that making sense of what has happened, in it becoming sometimes a meaningful, redeemed experience, I think that's where the deepest healing happens. I think that it's often an experience in a deep place of prayer. Often it happens on, for example, an eight-day retreat. People go away for a silent retreat for some really good quality time with God. And in that space, there is time to go deeper and to really allow themselves to soak in the love of the one who loves them unconditionally, who has created them, who knows what they need at their deepest place of pain.
You know, the way people say forgiveness or getting over resentment is a really important part of healing. Mm-hmm. Is that something that's significant as well? I mean, that, you know, it's really hard to forgive somebody who's raped you mm-hmm. or tortured you or whatever. Most people would find that very difficult. Is there something about getting the grace to do that which frees you, because the resentment only ties you mm-hmm. up?
I think so, definitely. And I think that's a process that can only come from grace, it's a gift of God. And one can't force it, forgiveness is not something that can be forced or rushed, particularly where the hurt is really profound. But I think that, you know, Ignatius has this thing about when you cannot pray for a particular gift, we pray for the desire to desire to desire to pray for that gift. And sometimes it's quite a number of steps back that one has to go. But I do believe that a great part of that healing is coming to a place of being able eventually to let go and to forgive.